All right. Hello, and welcome to another exciting NABBW teleseminar. Our topic tonight is one of special interest to all baby boomers, dealing with the impending death of a loved one, and more specifically, how to inject living into the life of someone who is dying. In a moment, I will introduce our guest, Linda Campanella, who has written of her experiences in her book, When All That's Left of Me Is Love, A Daughter's Story of Letting Go. This wonderful book was a 2011 Reader Views Literary Award first place winner in two categories and also received the Life Journeys Award for the best memoir or biography. It is published by Tate Publishing and available nationwide in libraries and your favorite online and offline bookstores, as well as in ebook format at TatePublishing.com. That's T-A-T-E Publishing.com. But first, before we get a chance to talk to Linda and answer the questions that I've promised you that we're going to be talking about tonight, let me introduce myself and do a bit of housekeeping. For those of you who do not know me, I am Ann Holmes, the Boomer-in-Chief of the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, which is found online at nabbw.com, and we have a forum at boomerwomenspeak.com. Our websites are the number one sites found via the major search engines when you search on the keywords baby boomer women. If you're not a member of the NABBW, and I know that a number of you on the call are not, you're welcome to join us. You'll find a handy link on the front page of the NABBW site, which you can use to join. This teleseminar is an example of the many benefits we provide our members. There are approximately 90 past teleseminars available online, providing written transcript and audio recordings of past calls. These are archived in the members-only area of the NABBW site. Now, as to tonight's call format, I'm planning to spend a few minutes introducing Linda Campanella in a moment, and then she and I will spend about 30 minutes discussing her experiences as she shared them in her book. After that, we'll open the call to questions from the audience, and we hope that you will bombard us with them. So let's get started. Let me begin with, as I promised, an introduction of Linda. Linda Campanella says that she did not plan to write a book and actually calls herself an accidental author. I love that term. She tells me that her book, When All That's Left of Me Is Love, A Daughter's Story of Letting Go, essentially wrote itself in the weeks of intense grief that immediately followed her mother Nancy's death in September 2009. It is her account of her last year with her terminally ill mother, and she says the chapters poured out of her at all hours of the day and night, flowing directly from her broken heart to a blank page. Linda finished the manuscript in less than 2 months, in time to give it to her father for Christmas. This was very important to her, as it was his first Christmas without his wife and sweetheart of 52 years. This is a story she never wanted or expected to tell, but now that it's written, she is happy to keep her mother's legacy of love and her joyful, generous spirit alive through its pages. Professionally, Linda Campanella keeps busy as a Connecticut-based management consultant. Her solo practice serves nonprofit organizations of all sizes and missions. In previous stops along her career path, she was a corporate executive in the aerospace industry, a senior administrator at a private college, and an international trade negotiator in the executive branch of the federal government. Linda lives in West Hartford, Connecticut, where she is married to her high school sweetheart, Joe, an architect. They have 3 sons in their 20s and an adorable 1-year-old mini golden doodle. Linda, welcome to the call.
Thank you, Anne. You're welcome.
I have to tell you that as I read your book, I realized that we had to do a teleseminar together for the NABBW membership. I say that because despite the sad topic and the painful story that you shared, your book, When All That's Left of Me Is Love, is truly an uplifting, hopeful, and life-affirming book. As people hear about it, they might not necessarily understand that, but yes, it's about anguish and death and tears and grief. But more than that, I see it as a story of love, faith, family, courage, and gratitude. You share how you and your family helped your mother spend the last months of her life in a living manner, not just as a patient who is waiting to die. Mm-hmm. I loved that you had your family happy hours, for example. You really wrote of your experience in learning to cry, letting go, holding on, connecting, believing in what is possible, resolving to stay in the moment, and of making a magical series of family memories, which means to me that you've written a book that is a loving tribute and an intensely personal memoir full of insights and inspirations that will likely prove helpful to others who read the book and who are also facing death. I mean, we're all facing death, of right. course, but either facing our own or our mother's or that of any other loved one. And, of course, anyone who reads the book knows that it's also a love story. It's the story of a special bond between you and your mother. And I was impressed also with how spiritual the book is. So, Linda, before I launch into the promised questions, having just told our listeners here a little bit about the book, I'd like to give you a brief opportunity to tell us what caused you to decide to contact a publisher and share your memoir with the world. I know that you originally saw the book as a Christmas gift for your father, or maybe it wasn't really first that. Maybe you just had to get it out of you, and then you gave it to him as a Christmas present. But now it's more than that. I see it as your gift to the world.
Oh, what a wonderful thing and generous thing for you to say. Thank you for sharing your reactions. I'm especially happy in that you found it uplifting. And I do think in many ways, even though the book is about death ostensibly, it's much more full of lessons for living than it's filled with lessons for dying. It is meant to be life-affirming and positive. And what brought me to write it and seek a publisher? Well, as you said, it sort of wrote itself in the first weeks after my mother's death, and it wrote itself quickly. So it was done in time for Christmas, and as I was approaching the holiday, I thought, boy, maybe I can finish this in time to give it to my father. And it was his reaction, as well as the reaction of a few other folks who read it, that made me think, gee, maybe I should consider sharing it more broadly than with my family. And if my father had not wanted me to do that, I wouldn't have, because, as you know, having read it, it is very personal. And there are things particularly about him and how he changed and grew and suffered, frankly, during that last year with my mother, that some people might not have felt comfortable sharing. And perhaps people like my father, who was a very private and stoic individual. And, you know, it was very heartening for me that he was not only willing but eager to share the story. And I think it's because it is a very loving tribute to my mother. And he misses her terribly. And if through the book he and we can keep her spirit alive and keep her present with us, that's a gift that keeps giving. So I think it was for some of those reasons that I did decide to seek a publisher. And I'm awfully glad I did. Surprised.
Okay, great.
Humbled, but happy.
Well, I'm delighted that you did, too. I think that I haven't read another book of exactly like this. I've read books, you know, like Kubler-Ross book on death and dying
right.
and those sorts of things, but it's not the same as the kind of book that you've written here. So excellent. I'm truly grateful that you did share this story.
Well, I think it was also, I should say, it was kind of a selfish act on my part, Anne. I wrote it to grieve. I wrote it to keep my mother near me. I have learned, because this really was my first experience with the death of somebody so close to me, that when we lose somebody that we cherish, we really need to talk. We need to share. We need to tell the story to keep the story. And in some respects, I think also the person we miss alive. So I felt that it was selfish, but if people are receiving it as a gift, that's a wonderful thing.
Oh, great. We're all better for it. So now that I've had that clarified for me, and I appreciate understanding how you made that journey, then let's go ahead and get to those dozen questions that we promised to cover this evening. Let's see. We have a letter, so let's just start at the top of the list of questions as I handed them out to people in the promotional materials that I wrote, so people can kind of follow along with us. So, based on your experience, the first question would be, how should someone expect that they will react to news like you received, news that a parent has been diagnosed with a terminal illness like cancer?
Okay, that's a big one, because all of us are so different, and so are the circumstances that surround things like this. So I feel like I can really only speak with authority about my own circumstances and my own reaction, but probably my reaction was not uncommon. And I'll just kind of set the table by describing what the circumstances were. On September 8th, 2008, my father called me around 5 o'clock in the evening and began the conversation by asking me if I was sitting down. And that's not a question any of us really looks forward to hearing, because in the movies
right.
and in other people's books, it's a question that leads to news that we don't want to hear. And in fact, on that night, the news was that my mother, who was 73 at the time, and had not been gravely ill with anything that would have made us suspect cancer, had been diagnosed that day with terminal metastatic lung cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They found 4 brain tumors, and the primary cancer was in her lung. And initially, I was absolutely paralyzed by shock, and I think that's probably a natural reaction that people might expect. I was too shocked to think. I was too shocked to cry, because the scenario that was described had been totally unimaginable. It seemed surreal, and that is a word that my siblings and I all kind of used. And I should say I have a younger brother and 2 younger sisters who were on this journey with me.
Mm-hmm.
Then the reality hit and the floodgates opened. I was able to cry, and trust me, I cried a lot. And I allowed myself to believe that the news actually was real, not surreal,
mm-hmm.
and that having a terminally ill mother was now my reality. And that was very disorienting. I didn't know what to do, how to think. And then really quickly, Anne, I entered a period of intense grief, and I've since learned that it's called anticipatory grief, because I immediately began to anticipate that day when my mother, who was my best friend, would no longer be part of my life, and when my father, who fell in love with her at first sight in 1956, would be a widower who was totally unprepared to deal in the world without his sweetheart. So I think this reaction, anticipating and then grieving a loss before it occurs, is kind of a natural response to news of a terminal diagnosis. Then I had another reaction. 48 hours later, I was lying in bed unable to sleep, and I had sort of an epiphany when I realized that although there was nothing I could do to keep my mother from dying, there was a lot that I could do and should do and must do to help her keep living. And that sort of became my self-appointed mission. From that point forward, I wanted to inject living into her life for as long as she lived. And I was able to kind of reel myself back in from that place of anticipatory grief that I had been launched to after my father called. And, you know, I think that's an important thing for folks to realize, that somebody who's terminally ill hasn't died yet. And, you know, mm-hmm. we don't need to grieve somebody who's not died yet. There was not a loss to grieve yet. So once that settled in my head, I turned my attention to focusing on being strong. That was another one of the reactions that people might expect. My mother didn't want us to be glum. That was her word. She didn't want us to cry. She didn't want to cry. She made very clear that she wanted to be strong for my father, and so we felt that we needed to be strong for her. And then kind of interestingly, this is kind of the last reaction I'll share. After I decided I needed to be strong, I decided, wow, maybe I need to be weak first, because all 3 of my siblings and I sort of independently had this worry that if we were too strong for my mother, she might think that underneath that facade of strength, our hearts weren't breaking, and we wanted to make sure that she knew that we were absolutely undone. So each one of us, in a different way and in a different time, did have a chance to talk with my mother and kind of give her a gut-wrenching declaration of our love. And once we did that and sort of got it out of the way, then we were able to get on with really concentrating on living and making sure that for however long she lived, it would be a full and joyful life. So I went from paralysis and shock to crying, to not being able to sleep, to anticipatory grief, and then kind of an epiphany that I shouldn't grieve prematurely, that life was still going on and we should embrace it.
Okay. Very,
I hope that answers your question.
very clearly explained.
Again, that was my reaction. It may not be anybody else's, but I think this anticipatory grief thing is very natural when there's a terminal diagnosis. We go mm-hmm. right to that place where the person we love is no longer in our lives.
Well, that makes sense. If I go back to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who I mentioned earlier, you know, mm-hmm. she does talk about the stages that a person goes through in death and dying, so it would make sense that as a daughter, you would have stages, not necessarily the same stages, but stages that you would go through. So that makes sense to me. And given that, I understand that you've said that, you know, one of your roles that therefore you played for your mother was, you know, a role to help her to concentrate on living, and
right.
and another role was to be strong. But overall, what would you say if you had to, you know, say more than just concentrate on living or be strong? What was the role that you played in caring for your mother during her illness, and did you feel that you were equipped to play that role? Or was it something that you uh-huh. had to really learn fast?
Well, you know, we have to learn on our feet when we're thrust into a situation that we don't expect, so I think I probably did. I am the oldest of the four kids, we're in our 50s.
Right.
The four children.
Well,
we refer to each other and ourselves as the kids. Anyway, I'm the oldest, and I'm also the one who lives closest geographically to my parents. I'm only a half hour away. And maybe for both of those reasons, I had a primary role in caring for my mother during that last year. Initially, my role was to be her companion. I really wanted to be with her and keep her company and keep my father company. So I was companion. I think I was confidant. And eventually I did become a primary caregiver together with my father, and I was supported wonderfully by my three siblings who lived, one in Washington State, one in New Jersey, and one in New Hampshire. And then I think I also played the role of strategic planner and project manager.
Okay.
And in those cases, my type A genes and my tendency to be a controlling person served me very, very well. I'd like to be in control. It gives me comfort, I think, and so I did kind of map out stuff and keep everything organized and was, if you will, kind of the project manager. And it helped the family navigate through uncharted territory. None of us had been down this path before. Mm-hmm. And I think that my plan of injecting living into my mother's dying pulled us all together and sort of became our game plan. And I don't know if I would say I was the coach, but I was maybe the team manager.
Okay. And would you say that some of those roles you think that were maybe easier for you to
emotionally
take on
I was unequipped by the way
being
you know
the oldest of the children
strategic
I mean,
planning
I
and project
man
that was kind of that was doing I was good at doing emotionally that's where I kind of learned along the way I didn't feel equipped for that but there's a lot of support that surrounded me along the way and that helped me I think
mm-hmm. Well somehow I think as an oldest daughter myself that somehow I haven't experienced what you've experienced here, of course, but it seems like part of my role in the family was always kind of a leadership role. So I don't know if that's the mm-hmm. same for all oldest children, but I think it might be.
Yeah, I think that's common. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say are some of the challenges that you found that are associated with caring for a dying parent, especially considering that you have to balance other important roles and responsibility. Mm-hmm. You can't mm-hmm. abdicate being a mother. You can't give up your job.
Right.
So how did you manage adding in the responsibilities that you took on and still have time to sleep?
Who said I had time to sleep?
Okay.
No, actually, when I had time, I had trouble sleeping because I was so preoccupied, and that's actually one of the difficulties. I think women are so good about our caregiver roles, but we don't tend to remember to take care of ourselves. And I think that's a lesson. And one of the things I probably did not excel at, which was taking care of myself physically and emotionally, that was perhaps one of my bigger challenges. But in other ways, I think I was really very fortunate in this regard. And it's almost as though my mother waited until I was in a position where I could devote myself to her care with minimal disruption and few competing priorities. In fact, it's kind of funny, may not be the right word, but I had told my mother as I approached this year and before we knew of her situation that I wasn't really looking forward to the year. I was turning 50. my youngest son was going off to college and I was going to be an empty nester. Our 14-year-old black lab was probably going to die, and it was going to be a year of transitions. And, you know, I was sort of bemoaning the fact that this was a year not to look forward to. You know, menopause, throw that into the mix. It was just kind of a yuck. And then after she was diagnosed, she joked, well, you didn't think you were also going to lose your mother this year, did you? Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, I didn't. But I was sort of in a good position. My youngest had gone off to college, and I had an empty nest. I had recently resigned as chair of a nonprofit board, so that freed me up. My consulting load at the time was relatively low compared to what it had been a few months previously, and I was in a position where I could not take on additional work if I didn't want to. And I had a husband who was 100% supportive of my doing whatever I wanted and of my being in Enfield with my parents as often and as long as I wanted. So I know that in many ways I was a lot luckier than others who have to play the role of caregiver. You know, too many of them have unsympathetic employers. Many have a house full of young kids who are very needy in their own right. And not everybody has a supportive spouse either. So under those circumstances, it's really difficult to play the balancing game. We may think we can do it all, but we really can't. Something has to give, either professional commitments or personal relationships. You know, and I recall a woman that I know who lost her senior position at a college on the East Coast because she insisted on being in California when her adult son was going through treatment for leukemia. So, you know, some people are not supported in the way that they should be and are not free to make some of the choices that I was able to make. But I do think when someone we love is dying or facing an acute chronic illness, our priorities shift, almost even without thinking about it, Anne, and almost always without regrets, even if there's a price to pay. So it's tough to balance, and it's tough to take care of ourselves, but somehow we rise to the occasion. Adrenaline kicks in. As I look back on it now, I have no idea how I did it. No idea. But, you know, we just do it. We do it because we love somebody so deeply. We do it.
Okay. Well, that certainly makes sense to me. And I understand, as a self-employed person, I understand that is a real benefit. And I speak from experience a little bit here. Some years ago, I've lost track of how many years ago, too many years ago. My first husband died when my kids were, my daughter had yet to turn 13. She turned 13 a couple of weeks after my first husband died, and my son was around 10. But I had been divorced from my first husband, and I had remarried. So I remember there came a time when I needed to take time off from work and asking my employer for a time off from work, and my employer was totally unsympathetic. I mean, he said, "This is your ex-husband. Why do you care? Why do you need to take time off?" And I had to look at him and say, "Let's not worry about that. He's my ex-husband. Let's look at it that this is my children's father." You know, and then at that point, then he could see that I still had a connection, that I still had a legitimate need to be asking for time off from work, but I think many employers don't understand when we have these types of illnesses that, you know, we need to be needing to take more time, and it's not a thing that's going to happen fast, and, you know, we don't know when the end time is to be.
So, and it's certainly not a choice we would make if we didn't have to either.
No, we certainly wouldn't say, "Oh, I think this year I'm going to do that."
Really.
But getting back to your book, it focuses, as you yourself did during your mother's last year, on ways that life can be lived fully. You talked about that earlier, that you were the person who was concentrating on living, and you wanted her to be able to live fully and joyfully even while anticipating death. So can we talk a little bit about how did you inject living into the dying process, and what advice you might offer others when they are confronting terminal illness?
Sure. I'd love to talk about that. That actually was the seed for the book. A few months before my mother died, my brother Eric actually suggested to me that I should write that's my beautiful Magda Doodle, mini doodle barking in the background if you can hear her. Sorry about that. Anyway, my brother suggested I write a book and call it Living While Dying, because he, as did my other siblings, really thought that we were doing something wonderful for my mother and for our family, and that what we were doing might be helpful to other people. So Eric's suggestion a few months before my mother died was the seed for the book, and it began to germinate after she died. And we did find many ways to inject living into dying, but I think, Ian, it started with a mindset. We really did look forward to each day as one that would bring new possibilities rather than as a day that would bring my mother one day closer to her death.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense. So, you know, we used a calendar to look ahead, not to check off days that she had managed to survive. So, you know, one of the key things was to not stop making plans. We plan tomorrow, we plan next week, we plan trips, we plan next month. And the longer she lived, the longer our planning horizon became. And that was really important, that we could still believe that there was a lot to look forward to. It also was important for us to retain as much of a normal existence and as many of our old routines as we could, kind of carrying on with life, hers and ours, as though we hadn't gotten the news. And that may sound like we were denying the reality, and we didn't really. But
mm-hmm.
we it's possible to suppress it if you really live in the moment. And that was our trick. And I think others who may have gone through this would agree that it's really important and helpful to stay in the moment and not let your minds fast forward to the ending. I mean, we knew how the story was going to end, but we liked to believe that we were still writing chapters as we were going. So we had a ton of family gatherings, planned ones, impromptu ones. We took many photos. We tried to go somewhere out of the house as often as possible. And, you know, as she became more infirm as the year went on, outings were even more important because they kind of injected some action into an existence that had become pretty inactive. You know, even when she couldn't walk except with her walker to the car, we'd go out, we'd do Dunkin' Donuts drive-through, or we'd go to Blockbuster Video before it went bankrupt and pick up some videos to watch. So we focused on possibilities rather than on what wasn't possible any longer, and we focused on things that we might do for the first time instead of focusing on things that might never happen again. So my mother and I had our first side-by-side mani-pedi, which was fantastic. We even created new family traditions, which is happy hour. You mentioned that at the beginning. This idea of happy hour, we would do it routinely at the end of the day, you know, 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. And it wasn't about booze. It was about setting aside a time of day to be together and to be happy, authentically so. And, you know, that became part of our routine. And you know, I carry it on to this day. So having routines is important. Keeping connections is important. It was really important for my mother to stay connected with people. We made sure that she kept her sense of humor. One of the things she confessed to us after she was diagnosed was she was afraid she'd lose her sense of humor, particularly since she had brain tumors. She didn't know how that would manifest itself, but worried that she wouldn't be able to laugh or love. And so we found it really important to retain our sense of humor and hers. And that's kind of a challenging thing. You know, when you get devastating news, it's almost as though you feel like you shouldn't be happy. That it's not okay to laugh, but in fact it is. It's really important. And it makes me think that as she was really nearing the end, she was in a hospital bed in our living room, and we had hospice. One day I came to her house, and I had an Elvis CD and put it in, and we did her exercises, you know, move your arm, move your legs to Elvis. And it was hysterical. You know, when you step aside and think about what we were doing, it's not a fun or funny situation at all, and yet we were doing her exercises in her hospital bed, singing along to Elvis. So that was important. And, you know, maybe the last thing I would say about how did we inject living into dying, we made sure that she had an opportunity to keep doing things because so much was being done to and done for her. And that, I think, for a terminally ill patient, Anne, is one of the most demotivating and demoralizing things. I know it was for my mother. She hated to think that she was a burden on her family or a burden to anybody. And so as her disease progressed, we really made sure that she had an opportunity to do as often as things were being done to and for her, you know, even if it meant wheeling herself to the refrigerator to get her own yogurt out of the refrigerator, or even if it was just folding the washcloths that had come out of the dryer. or putting tape on the Christmas presents that I was wrapping. She was doing instead of always being done to and for. So that the whole dignity thing was really important for us too. I'm not sure I answered your question. I feel like I maybe rambled off into other directions, but it's all about living, you know, living and and not dying.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And I don't think that you should worry that you didn't answer the question. There were just a number that you did, so you kind of had to list what they were. Now, you mentioned hospice in your answer there, and clearly hospice played a role in the journey and your mother's last days. And I've had some experience with hospice through my father-in-law and his experience with dying. I know that some people resist hospice care, and so you found like you had positive experiences with hospice. I'd like to ask you if you could talk a little bit about your experiences with hospice and whether you think there are misconceptions about hospice, and if there are misconceptions, how should we correct them, or what are the advantages that people need to know about in order to better understand hospice?
Well, you're right. I did have a very positive experience with hospice, and I am so thankful. And I'm also now finding myself wanting to be and trying to be a real advocate for hospice and palliative care. Hospice is one part of palliative care, which is a larger movement, if you will, within the healthcare system. Our hospice team really was angels on earth. Thanks to them, when my mother did pass away, and we got to the end of the story, if you will, my family members, certainly I, experienced a peacefulness and a gratitude that we never thought would be possible at such a sorrowful time in our lives. We had a team. There was a nurse who coordinated very closely with my mother's primary care physician. There also was a social worker and a spiritual counselor and a bereavement counselor, because with hospice, the commitment extends beyond the passing of the loved one to the year afterwards. So there is grief counseling for family members. And hospice care really understands that the suffering that a patient, particularly a terminally ill patient, experiences is not just physical. There's also existential suffering, emotional distress that's associated with anxiety or fear or the loss of dignity and hope and power, all those things that one loses or tends to. And so the hospice team was with us to address not only my mother's pain and symptoms, but also her worries and her spiritual needs. And there was comfort for her and also for us. Mm-hmm. So the goal really was patient comfort and then improving the quality of life. And there are, as you said, a lot of misperceptions about hospice, which is unfortunate. Some people think it's only for cancer patients, and that's not true. People think that patients go into hospice care when there's nothing else that can be done. They think that hospice accelerates death. These are not true at all. Somebody once said that hospice is not about giving up hope, but rather is about redefining hope, which I thought was really interesting. So maybe at the beginning, a terminally ill patient does kind of hope for a cure. But eventually that person is really hoping to live out life with joy, as much joy as possible, and with no pain. Mm-hmm. And that's really what hospice is all about. You know, I do think that, and I realized this at some point too on my own journey, that you reach a point where wishing to extend somebody's life is a selfish wish. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted my mother to live. I did not want to be without my mother. I couldn't imagine being without her. And I selfishly wanted her to live and live forever. But she made very clear that for her it was quality of life, not quantity of life. And we really wanted and needed to respect that. And another thing that I'll mention about hospice, Anne, is I think sometimes people might wait too long to bring in hospice, thinking that it's what you do in the last 24 hours. They don't really realize that hospice is all about quality of living. It's not just about dignified and pain-free dying. And I think people don't realize either that the hospice teams really help not only the patient but also the family. So hospice care is for the whole person and the whole family. And you know, we had hospice for 3 months before my mother died. And a family that waits until their loved one is almost literally on his or her last breath is really missing out on a wonderful, wonderful experience, truly, in terms of the emotional support. It was wonderful. I can't even describe it. We were surrounded by love and comfort for 3 months, not just my mother, but our whole family. And the hospice team came to the celebration of life, and we've stayed in touch. They're wonderful, wonderful people who really understand that the needs of dying people are unique and require specialized care. So I do hope that people understand hospice increasingly, and I hope the palliative care movement takes root and that people will take advantage of this really special care dispensed from the hearts and hands of people who are angels on earth. So as you can tell, I am a fan, and I am so, so grateful that we had hospice with us on the journey.
Now, it sounded to me like from the book that your experience with hospice was similar to what we experienced with my father-in-law, which is that the hospice staff or the hospice people that are working with you, your team, come to you wherever you are in your home but I think sometimes there's a hospice situation where a hospice is a place that people go, although I've never experienced a place of a hospice where people go. Is it generally done with a situation where they come into your home?
I don't know whether generally is the right word. I know that both options are available. There are hospice centers, and there is hospice care in lots of long-term care facilities. But then there also is the model where the hospice team comes to the home, and the person who is dying is allowed to die at home. And that's a very comforting thing. For us, it was wonderful. You know, we set up the day bed. We called it a day bed, not a hospital bed, in the living room, and I decorated it the way the couch that it replaced had looked. And it really looked as though my mother was just sort of sleeping in her living room. And it just, overall, the feeling of being at home was a feeling of comfort that I'm sure was very reassuring for my mother. And certainly it was a much lovelier experience for her family members. But, that doesn't work for everybody, Anne. In some cases, it's going to be in the hospital setting or a long-term care facility.
All right.
But the key is to consult the primary care physician early to explore the possibilities and to not wait until the very end. Because, as I said, there's a chance of missing out on this team of people who will just surround you and lift you with the support and love that you didn't know you needed, but you are so grateful for when you receive it.
Now, is it your experience with the study that you've done of hospice that your primary care physician will recommend it, or is it something that people might need to ask about?
Well, again, I think it's hard to generalize, Anne. I think most primary care physicians are aware of hospice, and in our case, it was a conversation that we, principally my father, and the primary care physician had in July. My mother was diagnosed in September, as I said, in June she had a major seizure and had to be hospitalized, and we had sort of turned a corner. So the conversation began then in June about perhaps moving to hospice care. And it was a decision made jointly between the primary care physician and the family. In some cases, it may be a discussion that's initiated by the family. I think oftentimes it will be initiated by the physician because families are unfamiliar with hospice. There was a study done recently by it's an organization called the Center for the Advancement of Palliative Care. And as I said, hospice care is just one kind of palliative care. Palliative care actually can be for disease, whether it's terminal or acute or chronic, kind of at any age or stage. It's about quality of life and relieving suffering. So there is this organization called the Center for the Advancement of Palliative Care, and they recently did a study and found out that 92% of Americans said that they would likely want palliative care for themselves or a loved one facing severe illness. But, and this is the hook, almost as many people first needed to be told what palliative care is. So I think there's a real need to educate the public about hospice care and about palliative care so that we can all advocate for ourselves in the healthcare system, which, as I think we all know and lament, is very complex. And when you're in it and it's a serious, stressful situation, we don't always think to ask the right questions, or we don't always know the right questions to ask. So hopefully it's a movement that will catch on. Right now I think there's palliative care in 1 out of 4 hospitals, so there's a lot of ways to go, quite a distance to go yet.
All right. Well, I'm glad that you brought it up so well, and in the book and in this discussion, because hopefully if people aren't familiar with the term, this will be a way that they can go
do
out
some homework.
And find out about it. And if they aren't familiar, I can spell the word. I believe it's P-A-L-L-I-A-T-I-V-E.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, in case they need to do a little Google research on it. Okay. Now, what are some of the most valuable lessons that you learned as a result of your experience? So lessons mm-hmm. that might be helpful to other daughters facing the prospect of caring for and eventually losing a terminally mm-hmm. ill parent.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that one of the first things that I would mention is that I learned how lucky I am to have adored my mother and to have been adored by her and to have had her in my life for as long as I did. I realize that not everybody is that lucky. Either mm-hmm. They don't have that kind of relationship with their mother, or they don't get to live to be 51 years old and have a mother in their lives that long. So I'm keenly aware of the fact that I'm lucky in that regard. And I think I would also mention that context that I know that my mother's death was not tragic, and I feel lucky about that. There are women who lose children, and there are people who die very young of cancer. My mother was the first to say that hers was not a tragic story. But, you know, it was a story of personal loss, and the truth of the matter is that when the loss is your personal loss, whether it's tragic or not, it really hurts like hell.
Mm-hmm.
So,
no doubt.
So, I mean, that's something I learned. And then I also learned, and maybe this is encouraging for people who may find themselves in a similar situation, that a terminal diagnosis in many ways is a gift. And people told me that, Anne, after they learned that my mother was terminally ill, and I didn't believe it. I didn't buy it. They said, oh, it could be the most beautiful thing. And it felt terrible. It didn't feel beautiful to me, and it did not feel like a gift. It felt like the earth moved, you know, that my life had changed in a way that I couldn't cope. But it was a gift. Let me just mention what I mean by that. For us, and I think for others, there's the chance to eulogize somebody while she's still living, rather than you save all those good things to say about somebody at a memorial service. So, you know, with a terminal diagnosis, there's the chance to make sure that your loved one understands how deeply she is loved. There's the chance to give somebody a good death, which is a term one of my friends used. And I think that is a gift, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And hospice was a big part of that for us. There's the chance to leave nothing unsaid, and there is a chance to say goodbye, which is a huge gift. There's a chance to forgive and to heal any wounded relationships. So a terminal diagnosis, whether it makes sense or not, is a gift. And part of that gift is welcoming every day and living it as though it is your last one. And in fact, when you stop to think of it, each one of us already has been given a terminal diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the real lesson is to live that way regardless, without the shock of a diagnosis of terminal.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's one of the key lessons, a lesson for living. And then another lesson, and maybe I'll offer this in the way of a tribute to my mother, who was an amazing woman, smart, generous, loving. The other lesson has to do with what kind of a life really matters. And she was so proud of me, and my resume is, I suppose, more impressive than my mother's would have been. She chose to stay at home and raise four children and be a wonderful wife and member of the community. But the irony, if it is ironic, is that I would rather my obituary be more like my mother's. You know, I would want to be remembered the way she is going to be remembered, for the way she loved and was loved, and for her grace and graciousness and being a wonderful friend and wife and mother. And while my mother was going through this illness, my alma mater, Amherst College, was going through a capital campaign, and the theme for it was Lives of Consequence. And there were quite a few alumni who engaged in some online dialogue and debate about the choice of that phrase as the theme for a capital campaign, and pointed out that the people who were being featured as part of the campaign were very accomplished in sort of the expected ways, the banker, the lawyer, the business person. And so there was a lot of debate about what really does matter, and it was a lovely conversation, and I actually interjected my own voice and talked about my mother. And by some criteria, her life didn't really add up to much as a life of consequence, but I think in terms of what really matters in the final analysis, her life was a life of tremendous consequence. And that is another lesson that I learned. So, again, maybe I'm rambling a little bit. I will say that somebody who read the book said to me, your mother was a warrior for hope and love. Isn't that fantastic?
Oh, that's a fabulous...
Yeah, that is so much better than my resume, which you so generously read at the beginning of this interview. Does any of that matter in the end? Maybe not, but my mother's life mattered. And that's a lesson, again, a lesson for living, mm-hmm. not a lesson for dying. So even though the book, as I said, kind of deals with death ostensibly, I think and I hope ultimately it's going to be valued and appreciated for lessons about living.
Oh, excellent point. Now, you talked about experiencing a good death, and mm-hmm. then in retrospect, as we look back on your mother's illness, you would probably say that you were able to have what some people have called a long goodbye.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't an accident like a car crash where, you know, mm-hmm. it happened that you had time to have those conversations with her
right.
and the things that you've been discussing here, so that I don't need to reiterate because I don't want to take up too much of the time with a question. But
right.
with looking back on it and having experienced this long goodbye, do
yeah.
you think that it's easier to deal with the certain death, such as you knew that you were experiencing, or that sudden death of you know, that happened with a car crash or
mm-hmm.
or a drowning or something like that, you know,
yeah.
a death where you don't have a time to prepare for the loss of a parent or a loved one?
You know, it's really hard to say whether one is better or easier because they're both so terrible. But interestingly enough, I had an opportunity to compare and contrast those two things within my own family within the same week. My mother was a week away from dying, and we were actually holding vigil by her bedside when we got the word that my father-in-law had had a massive stroke. And my husband was able to make it to Cape Cod in time to take him off life support. So 5 days before my mother died, after a year-long terminal illness, my father-in-law died completely unexpectedly. We had expected him to live for many years.
Oh, wow.
So that was definitely surreal, and it was just horrible. It defied description what we went through in terms of our emotions. But I can tell you that with the long goodbye, it's excruciating as you are going through that anticipatory grief. The pain was never away, even though I was able to suppress thoughts about how the story was going to end. I always had a terrible ache, and I did an awful lot of crying during that year, and it was awful to watch my father suffer, anticipating his life without his wife. So it was excruciating, I have to say. The long goodbye was excruciating. But the good thing is we had a goodbye. My mother-in-law did not. And so while the year leading up to our expected goodbye was very difficult, I would say our ability to cope with loss and to grieve has perhaps been a little bit easier than hers has been. The year after losing her husband unexpectedly was excruciating for her. So all I can say, Anne, is that I'm grateful. I'm grateful that I did have the chance to say goodbye, and grateful that my mother knew how much she was loved, and you know, grateful for many things that went along with the pain of that long goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
They're both terrible, though.
Yes, I'm sure it was terrible. In fact, this is maybe a terrible question to ask, but were there times during the long goodbye when you wanted to say, oh, I wish we would just get this over with? This is just so painful to be going through it, or was that not a situation?
I can't remember ever having that thought.
Okay.
I didn't want it to end. I didn't want it to end. And she was very fortunate, I should say, in that her cancer symptoms were really held in check pretty much until the end. She had a lot of fatigue, but that was primarily a result of the treatment that she underwent. And that's one of the biggest challenges when there is cancer treatment. You know, my mother could have done great if it were not for her fatigue. She called it lack of oomph. So I never found myself wishing that it would just end. I didn't want it to end. I wanted her to defy the odds and live into her 90s, which was always our plan. But it wasn't meant to be.
All right. Well, given that and the wonderful book that has resulted, let's move on to the question of talking about what are some of the things that your friends did for you during this time that you found that were especially helpful for you. In other words, I guess the question would be, what are some of the most helpful things friends can do for or say to someone who is terminally ill or someone who is caring for a terminally ill family member? I know that many times I've found myself feeling like I'm at a loss for words in situations like that, and I'm sure that you experienced people that didn't know what to say to you. So what would you advise? Are there things that people should avoid saying or doing, or should we look at it from the other side of the coin? What should they do?
Well, that's kind of a two-pronged question, if I understand it correctly, and I'll talk about my friends first and what they did for me or could say to me, and then we can talk about what to say to the patient, him or herself. As far as I'm concerned, or my experience was concerned, and my friends, they were critical for me. Someone once said that when you laugh, the whole world laughs with you. When you cry with your girlfriends. Mm-hmm. And for me, my friends made it possible to cry. They were an outlet for my fears and tears. As I said earlier, I was really trying and needing to be strong for my father, for my mother, for others in my family. So I had this feeling that I needed to be strong. But at the same time, I really needed an outlet for my tears. And my friends provided that outlet. And in fact, when the book was going through my final editing, there was one chapter I had to take out because in the end it didn't fit. And it was a title and chapter entitled With a Little Help from My Friends. And I really did want to give a shout out to them because they made it possible for me to cope. Some of them had experienced loss themselves and could empathize with me. So I would say being an outlet for my tears and providing empathy were invaluable gifts from my friends in terms of the role they played in my last year. Relative to what people might say to somebody who's terminally ill, if that was the second part of your question, I hope I understood it correctly.
Right.
You know, I think it's important not to be afraid to ask how the person is feeling emotionally as well as physically. And having said that, I would caution against trying to be a counselor and offering any advice, but asking and listening are really great gifts. So, you know, ask how they're feeling. And don't be afraid to tell them how much you love them and will miss them if it's somebody who's really, really dear to you. It's nice to ask them to talk about their lives. I think people who are approaching the end of their lives really appreciate the opportunity to look back and to talk and to share and remember. So letting people know that you're willing to listen is a really wonderful gift. And then I think just being present. Never underestimate the value of one's presence. Even if it feels like you're not doing anything, being present sends a really important message. And so does touch. You know, there's nothing more reassuring than a touch, whether it's a hug or just, you know, putting your hand on her hand or his hand and squeezing. Those are some thoughts that come to mind. But I know that feeling of not knowing what to do. And I think because of that, many of us tend not to do much or say much. And yet,
I don't
think there's anything really wrong to say or do. To tell you the truth, there's a need to connect.
One of my challenges has always been, do you acknowledge to them that you understand that they are in a process that's going to end with death, or do you try to always present the bright side of, you know, hopefully things will turn around or there could be a miracle or you know.
I think you follow their lead. Follow their lead. It's easier if the patient, him or herself, brings that up, because that sort of gives permission and makes it okay to talk about it, you know, not in a maudlin way, but in an appropriate way.
Right.
So you kind of follow the lead of the individual. Somebody spoke with me a few months back for an interview, and it was on the subject of being a warrior. You know, and there is that kind of a tendency to want the patient to fight. You know, fight, keep fighting. Well, you know, at some point we reach the point where there's no more fight, and it doesn't make sense to fight, and we just kind of give in to the inevitable and accept it and welcome it. And, you know, again, hospice can be very, very helpful at that point. So I think I would caution against this warrior mentality and really encouraging people to fight, keep fighting, keep fighting. You know, a terminal illness is going to end with death. And while we might hope for miracles, they are few and far between in reality. So I think respecting the reality, not dwelling on it, of course. I mean, I didn't like to talk about death during the whole year leading up to my mother's life because we were focusing on living. But, you know, there were times when I needed to go to that place with my mother because she needed to go there. And what she needed was far more important than what I or anybody else in the family needed. So, again, taking cues from the individual who is making the journey herself is probably a helpful thing to do.
All right. What do you think are some of the most important insights, valuable lessons perhaps, that that you would be able to share with others who are facing death or loss? I guess how might your mother's example or your family's experience be inspiring or reassuring for others who are on the, are listening here?
Well, I may already have answered that one. Lessons. I don't know. I'm coming up with a blank on that one, Ann. I'm sorry to say.
Maybe, you know, we've talked about, you know, things like concentrating on living and and those sorts of things. So maybe we did cover that already. And I so let's just go on and say we did answer that one. I'm curious. And I'm sure others are. I know you explain it in the book, but I'm sure that others are curious as to the significance of the title for the book, When All That's Left Is Love. So could we talk a little bit about how you came to title the book, and then along with that perhaps talk about how can we keep someone who is physically gone present in our lives, which you have mentioned a couple of times here during the call, that your mother continues to be a presence in your life.
Okay, with the title, I'll kind of set it up with a few quick anecdotes. In the fall, a couple of weeks after my mother was diagnosed, she and my father went to the family cottage to close it up for the season. And at that time, she did not expect that she would be back in the spring to open up the cottage, which was sort of the ritual. And as she left the cottage for the last time, what she thought would be the last time that September after being diagnosed, she ran back in and on the mirror wrote in lipstick, "Love, always love." And that was surely what she thought would be her final message to us that would be delivered to us after she died. So that's one thing I want to mention. Another thing I'll mention is that my brother, who gave me the idea for the book originally, had suggested the title Living While Dying. But when I had a publishing consultant read my manuscript, she had very few bits of feedback for me. But one of the things she said was, would you be open to a title change? And that made me think that, in fact, Living While Dying was sort of a maudlin title, and I needed to maybe give it some other thought. And where I found my answer was in a poem that I included in the book. And there are a lot of poems in the book. Poetry was significant during my mother's last year, and it was very significant and helpful to me in my first few months as I was grieving, which is why I included a lot of wonderful poems in the book.
You did.
And one of them, I don't know if time permits, Anne. I could read it. It's not a long one.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll read the end of it. You can love me most by letting hands touch hands, by letting bodies touch bodies, and by letting go of children that need to be free. Love doesn't die. People do. So when all that's left of me is love, give me away. So when I was hunting for a different title, that kind of jumped out at me. When all that's left of me is love, give me away. And at one point I had included Give Me Away in the title, and then I decided to cut it. And I think that the significance of it and why it resonated with me is I believe that my mother wanted us to know that we would and we should continue to love her by loving others, and that her love would never die, particularly if we gave it away, if you will. So we would have to let go of her body, but while her body died, her love wouldn't. And so the significance for me is that her love still lives in us and through us, and I continue to love her by loving others. And in the book I wrote, if all that remains of Mom now is love that will not die, that is so very much, and we must give it away, understanding that in giving it away, we also keep it. Her love, she, lives in our hearts. So that's sort of the significance of it, to me anyway. It speaks to me, and I think it's been speaking to others who've read the book.
It really spoke to me. Has that been the main reaction to the book, or have there been other reactions to it that are something that you'd like to talk about?
Well, the reaction has been really positive from people who have experienced loss and find themselves reconnecting with their mothers through reading about mine, for people who are going through this journey now and find some inspiration in the example that my family offers. There's been a really positive reaction even from within the palliative care community. I'm really excited about that. Actually, several pioneering physicians in the field of hospice and palliative care have had really good things to say about the book. So I'm hopeful that it might be helpful to hospice practitioners and spiritual counselors and anybody who's involved in end-of-life care. But, you know, I think mostly it's a memoir that is speaking to people and is moving people, which makes me happy, I have to say. Makes me happy. People are getting to know my mother. I love when people write to me, oh, I really feel as though I got to know your mother. She was wonderful. That, of course, pleases me. And what I love also, Anne, is that the telling of my story is prompting others to tell their stories. So I'm finding that I'm connecting with people in a place of shared humanity and also shared vulnerability. So I'm particularly loving the conversations that the book is sparking. I've heard some great stories from women about their mothers and about their experience with death and how they stay connected with their mothers even after they've died. So I love the sharing that it's prompting. That's, I guess, perhaps one of the most gratifying responses is other people opening up to me.
Excellent. I'm really glad to hear that they have been doing that. I know I did.
Yes, you did. You told me about your story, and I thought that was great. Mm-hmm. You know, we all experience loss. It's a very personal story, my book is, but the themes are quite universal, and so it seems to be resonating. But I do hope people will take away from this conversation between you and me that it is an uplifting, life-affirming book. There's a lot in it that I think will help us all, and I reread it myself frequently as a way of connecting with my mother, but also as a way of being reminded of her lessons. You know, it's a lesson for living. You know, don't wait to say things until it's too late. Don't be stingy with your love or with I love yous. You know, give them away abundantly.
It's very good. That's a very good lesson, and I don't think it can be said enough to not be stingy with saying I love you. I think that too many times we don't say that enough in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad that you're bringing that up. Well, I really think that this has been a great discussion, and our time has really flown by. I'm looking at the clock and see that we've already been talking for an hour, but I do have some questions that have come in. So I know it's late for you.
On the East Coast, this is late for a baby boomer woman, but
but if you would permit me a couple of questions that people have sent in.
Oh, I'd love to hear what they're thinking. Sure.
Do some questions that way, and then I'll remind people again before we close the call on how they can get a copy of your book. But we've got a question here from Diane in Las Cruces, and she says, hi, Linda. My mother died when I was 18, almost 37 years ago. Mm. I believe I still experience post-traumatic stress from her death, having received no counseling back when she died. Is it too late for counseling?
Well, I'm not an expert on counseling, and I would not dispense advice, but I will offer the opinion that it's never too late for counseling. If we are experiencing pain emotional or otherwise, there is help to be had. And I would encourage you, Diane, to find somebody to talk with, to let those tears come out, to be reassured that what you're feeling is normal. Absolutely, I would get counseling. And I would also mention, Diane, you might want to check out a website group that I have found. It's a Facebook forum called Motherless Daughters, or there's a group for Motherless Daughters, and it was started by Hope Edelman, who is an award-winning journalist and author who actually wrote the book Motherless Daughters quite a few years ago, and it became kind of the seminal book on this topic. And you would be amazed, as I was, to find how many women are part of this Motherless Daughters Club and how we really appreciate the opportunity to talk with each other, to share with each other, no matter how long ago we lost our mother, no matter what the circumstances, we're finding a common experience and a connection. And it's just a great place to share some of your thoughts and to ask whether others have had similar experiences or may have some advice for you. So I would encourage you, Diane, definitely think about counseling with a professional who will have lots of wisdom, I'm sure. And then also to connect with other women who are in this big club called Motherless Daughters. And one possibility would be that Facebook group called Motherless Daughters.
Excellent. I was not familiar with that group, so thank you.
Yeah, you may want to check it out too, Anne.
All right. We have another question here, which is, how did your children cope with the situation? You know, they mm-hmm. of course, were having a dying grandparent, and at the same time, they were seeing you so consumed by your sadness and by your caregiving.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And, you know, if I have one regret, it probably is that I didn't pay enough attention to my kids and how they were grieving. And, you know, kids, again, in quotation marks, they are now in their 20s. My youngest went off to college and was starting his sophomore year when he lost his grandparents. The other son was a junior in college, and one was out of college already. So they were out of the nest, and they were not experiencing everything with me day by day. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, the loss was very intense because my kids grew up very, very close to both sets of grandparents. And in fact, until my mother and my father-in-law died in September 2009, my children had four grandparents in their lives, which is highly unusual, and I'm not sure they knew just how lucky they were. I wish I had spent a little bit more time indulging their grief and making sure that they were doing all right. I think during the year they coped pretty well. The goodbye was very difficult for them, particularly, I mean, they had a goodbye with my mother. They didn't with my father-in-law. That was very hard, and I think that was probably the hardest thing for them, in addition to watching their mother suffer. That none of us likes to watch somebody we love in pain, and I know that was hard for them. Maybe even harder than watching my mother, because she was so brave. But I do kind of regret or wonder whether or not I spent enough time really exploring with my children how deep their pain was after they lost their grandparents. We've talked about it subsequently. One of my children had a little bit of depression, and that's perhaps why I'm wondering whether maybe I didn't do enough. I think I'm lucky that they were adult children who understood what was going on and not young kids for whom this was a very scary mystery mm-hmm. that needed to be explained.
Excellent. Now I've got a question from Nancy in Tucson. She wants to know, have you found it easier to deal with the loss of your mother with the passage of time?
Nancy, I have found it easier. At the beginning, I probably cried every day. I felt discombobulated, disconnected. It felt like my world was amiss and it would be fixed soon. I kept thinking that she was going to come around a corner. You know, I had kind of the typical grief reaction and wondered whether I would ever feel whole again and happy again. And the good news is that I do. And it happened gradually. but it happens, and that's the good news. And it happens at a different pace and in different ways for everybody. One thing I've learned, and I've certainly read it, there's no right or wrong way to grieve, and there's no appropriate moment when suddenly we feel better or the grief stops and we move to a different phase. It evolves. But the pain does dissipate. The memories become happy memories. I find that when I think of her, I have really happy memories now, and I smile much more often than I cry. It still doesn't take much to cause me to cry. If somebody says the right thing, I can well up immediately, but it's not with me every moment. It's not as intense. I guess that's probably the best way to answer that. Time All heals. Right. Time does help, and it heals.
It's not just a cliche. It does heal.
I mean, originally, soon after my mother died, there were certain pieces of music that I couldn't listen to. I physically couldn't listen to them. And I wasn't ready right away to have a picture of her on my desk. But now I have one that stares at me, and she's beaming. She's got a huge smile. And I look at it, and what I remember about her and miss the most is her laugh and her smile. But somehow I'm comforted, and I feel her company looking at that picture. Whereas soon after she died, I wasn't really ready to do that. So, the grief takes different shapes and different levels of intensity, but it gets better, Nancy.
Okay, now you said that your father was fine with you publishing the book, which we mentioned that way in the beginning, but I have a question here about how is he doing?
He is doing great. He's doing great. Time has helped him as well. One of the chapters in my book that I love most is the chapter about the love story between my parents. And it really was a wonderful love story. And I would never have predicted that he would do as well as he's doing. And I guess I have to credit my mother. I think that her spirit is burning very brightly in him. And I'm grateful to her as well that her dying wish was, "Don't be sad." Those three words have given me so much strength and direction, and I think have also helped my father. We all know that my mother would be exceedingly unhappy, maybe even mad at us if we were sad. She wants us to be happy, and so that's given us inspiration. And we put one foot in front of the other, and we accept the help when it's offered, and he's doing well. He's in a great retirement community. There are some lovely neighbors who we'll bring him a chunk of lasagna every once in a while or a great soup and take good care of him. And I'm close enough that I visit very often. And he's doing well. He's doing well.
Oh, that's really good to hear. I'm curious, do you anticipate, now that you've jumped in and written a book, do you think that you'll be writing any more books?
That's a question that I get asked often. And the quick answer is no. I can't imagine doing it. I never intended to do this one. As you said, I consider myself an accidental author. This book kind of wrote itself, and it wrote itself quickly when the emotions were so intense. I remembered every smell, every sentence spoken during that year. It's very, very odd and hard to explain, and I think it's because of the intensity of what I was experiencing. If I had decided today to write this book, Anne, I couldn't. I couldn't recall what I recalled in those moments of really intense grief after she died. So unless something really intense happens to me again and provides fodder for a book, I can't imagine doing it. I'm definitely not a fiction writer. You mentioned my resume. I'm a business person. I write memos, not memoirs.
Right.
So I have no plans to write another book, but who knows? Inspiration could come from somewhere. We'll see. Never say never, right?
Right. Absolutely. Is there anyone, I haven't really given a chance for people that are on the call, and we do have the lines open. So if there's anyone that's on the call that has a question, even though we are past the hour, I'd be certainly remiss if I didn't give people a chance to after you've listened to this and have questions, to not give you a chance to speak out and ask them. So don't let me end this call without that. Is there anyone on the call who would like to ask a question? Does that mean we've answered them all, Linda? I don't know.
Well, while they get up their courage to ask if there's anybody on the line, I will mention, as you suggested, I do, That there is information about my book on the web. I have a website where you can learn more about the book if you're still curious, and that website is www.lindacampanella, that's all one word, Linda, C-A-M-P-A-N-E-L-L-A, at Tate Author, TateAuthor.com. There's a lot of information, and there are also some beautiful pictures of my mother on that website, so I encourage you to visit it if you're interested. And there's also a Facebook page, Linda Campanella Author.
Right.
And there's information there, and feel free to like the page, because my publisher has certainly impressed upon me that a great way to spread the word is through social networking. And as you said, now that it's written, and I do believe it's a loving tribute to my mother, I am eager to share it. I have to confess, I'm eager to share it widely. So thank you to anybody who reads it, and if you do, I would welcome your feedback at any time. It doesn't have to be tonight. I love the conversations and the connections, as I said earlier. I really do.
Very good. And again, that's if you didn't, anybody listening didn't get that before, the Facebook page is Linda, it's separate words here, Linda Campanella, C-A-M-P-A-N-E-L-L-A, comma, author. That's the Facebook page. And then your website is www.lindacampanella, all together, one word, at Tate, T-A-T-E, author.com.
And actually, it's not at Tate, it's dot TateAuthor.com.
Tate.
So lindacampanella.TateAuthor.com.
Okay. All
Thanks.
Right. Good. Well, it's just been wonderful talking with you this evening, Linda, and I thank you for being our guest and for the great discussion. I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. Be sure to look for Linda's book at your favorite bookstore or online, and remember that the title is When All That's Left of Me Is Love, : A Daughter's Story of Letting Go, and it's available both in paperback and there's an instantly e-book format that's also available. Is that only available at the Tate Author website?
No, I think Amazon.com offers a version for Kindle, and Barnes & Noble has an e-version for the Nook, so it's available in both formats.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's great.
So
Thank you so much.
I love the instantly downloadable because, you know, that means that anyone who's listening here tonight and says, oh, I've got to read this right now, you know, they don't have to wait till tomorrow or till...
That's true. And it's a pretty quick read from what people are saying. Pretty quick
read.
Thank you so much for having me on your program. And as I said earlier, there's a certain need to share and to talk. And so I really appreciate this opportunity and... hope that through this hour plus, I will make some new connections.
Oh, I certainly hope so.
Women out there.
Well, there's a lot of boomer women, and many of us, if we haven't already faced up to the death of loved ones, especially our parents, as you said, we're sandwich generation. It's something that we are all going to face, and you've done a wonderful job of telling people your story and helping us to know that we can manage to live through it when the time comes, because actually, you know, we don't have much choice. But you've paved the way here, I think, for people to know that they can make it through. And I think the wonderful thing that you've done here is to stress this concept of living while dying. I really think
joyful that's living.
Important. Joyful living.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thanks again, Anne.
Thank you, and good night, everyone.
Bye-bye, everybody.